Despite warnings from U.S. President Biden, Israel launches strikes on Rafah.
Many Palestinians say they fear a new Nakba, or catastrophe.
An aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan moves forward in the U.S. Senate.
Today, it's no exaggeration to say that the eyes of the world are on the United States Senate.
And digitizing Nigerian history, not just for people to read, but so that it can be absorbed by artificial intelligence.
Page by fragile page, these old Nigerian newspapers are being scanned and uploaded to a back-end server.
Today is Monday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel launched airstrikes on Gaza's southern city of Rafah in the early morning hours on Monday. The White House had reaffirmed President Joe Biden's view that the military operation in Rafah should not proceed without a plan to ensure the safety of the more than 1 million people sheltering there. Here's Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder with an overview of the situation in Rafah.
Israel has ordered Palestinian residents to move ever further south over the course of the war. But now there's nowhere obvious to go, prompting the UN to warn Israel against the mass displacement of Palestinians from Gaza.
We would not support in any way forced displacement, which goes against international law.
More than half of Gaza's 2.3 million people are sheltering in Rafah, right up to the border fence with Egypt. They're subject to deadly Israeli strikes and dire humanitarian conditions. Aid agencies have warned large numbers of civilians could die and that there's nowhere safe for people to go. They tell you there's a safe place, but on the way they bomb people, Deeb Ghanem says. Many Palestinians say they fear a new Nakba, or catastrophe. That's when 700,000 Palestinians were dispossessed from their homes during the Arab-Israeli War of 1948. United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has warned of mass displacement for months. This was his spokesperson, Stefan Dujarric, on February 9th.
I think what is clear is that people need to be protected, but we also do not want to see any forced mass displacement of people, which is by definition against their will.
Arab nations, especially neighbours Egypt and Jordan, strongly oppose any Israeli attempt to push Palestinians over the border. Egypt says it will not allow such movement onto its territory and has kept the border closed, only allowing a few thousand foreigners, dual nationals, and a handful of others to cross. It has strengthened security and border defences in Sinai. Arab countries say Palestinians must not be driven from the land where they want to make a future state, including Gaza. Israel has dismissed all suggestions that mass displacement is on its agenda. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says it has ordered the military to develop a plan to evacuate the population of Rafah. It says four Hamas battalions are deployed there. But comments by some high-ranking Israeli politicians have stoked fears. Israeli Agriculture Minister Avi Dichter told Israel's Channel 12 in November, "This is Gaza's Nakba." In late January, far-right Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir publicly urged Jewish settlers to return and resettle Gaza, to rapturous applause. Palestinians said his words amounted to a call for their forced deportation. He prompted a reprimand from White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby.
Irresponsible, reckless. We have made clear that there can be no reduction in Gazan territory.
Israel launched its war on Gaza on October 7, after Hamas militants infiltrated the border, killed about 1,200 people, and took some 250 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. Gaza's health ministry says more than 28,000 Palestinians have been killed in the months since.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. A narrowly divided U.S. Senate moved closer to passing a $95 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan on Sunday, showing bipartisanship despite growing opposition from Republican hardliners and former U.S. President Donald Trump. The Democratic-led Senate cleared the latest procedural hurdle and moved the foreign aid measure further on toward an ultimate vote on passage at some point in the coming days. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking for the measure to move forward.
So today, it's no exaggeration to say that the eyes of the world are on the United States Senate. Our allies and partners are hoping that the indispensable nation, the leader of the free world, has the resolve to continue. And our adversaries are hoping for something quite different. Friends and foes alike pay close attention to what we say here and to how we vote, because American leadership matters, and it is in question.
Russia attacked Ukraine with a barrage of drones early Sunday. Ukraine funding is becoming a key issue in the U.S. presidential election, and as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, the two U.S. presidential frontrunners have diametrically opposed views on Ukraine and on NATO.
Police body camera footage shows the first moments as rescue workers arrive at burning houses following a deadly Russian drone attack in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. VOA cannot independently verify the date or location of the video. At least seven people died in the attack, including three young children. The New York Times reported the strike hit a local depot, causing burning fuel to flow through the streets, trapping families in burning homes. Ukraine faces an uncertain future in its war against invading Russian forces. While the European Union recently approved a robust four-year, $54 billion aid package, continued funding from the United States may prove more challenging. U.S. President Joe Biden recently welcomed fellow NATO member German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to the White House and stressed the need of getting a new Ukraine aid package through the bitterly divided U.S. Congress.
We have to pass the national security spending package now. Our House members are being somewhat reluctant. Hopefully it's more politics than real, but including funding for Ukraine and to help them continue to defend themselves against the brutal aggression of Russia.
Ukraine relies on the financial and material support of primarily NATO member states for its efforts to defend itself against Russia. Biden's likely challenger for the presidency, Donald Trump, said that as president, he had warned an unidentified NATO member to spend more on defense or Russia can do what it wants.
I came in, I made a speech, and I said, you got to pay up. They asked me that question. One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us? I said, you didn't pay? You're delinquent? He said, yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay.
In a statement Sunday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that any suggestion that NATO allies would not defend each other undermines all of our security, including that of the U.S. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Around 100,000 people gathered in Munich on Sunday, according to the city's authorities, holding up protest banners and lights in protest against right-wing extremism, anti-Semitism, and the far-right Alternative for Germany party, the AfD. These protests across Germany against the rise of the far right are now entering their fifth week. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin was taken to a Washington, D.C. hospital on Sunday for treatment of symptoms suggesting an emergent bladder issue. A Pentagon spokesman said Austin, who is 70, was turning his duties over to his deputy. This is the second hospitalization for this issue following treatment for cancer last year. Center-right Alexander Stubb of the National Coalition Party narrowly won Finland's presidential election runoff on Sunday. National Coalition Party Secretary Kristiina Koko.
So we are very excited and, of course, very pleased that we are now heading this moment.
Stubb is pro-European. and a strong supporter of Ukraine. Results from Pakistan's February 8th general election show candidates backed by former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan winning the most seats in the National Assembly, despite a months-long military-backed crackdown on his party and the fact that he's in jail. But as VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman reports from Lahore, the results may not push the military to give up its hold on political power.
Waleed Iqbal is a member of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf.
I would call it a vote against every anti-PTI force. So I would say a vote opposed to, you know, PTI's witch hunt.
Observers say the vote is a message for the powerful military that plays an outsized role in Pakistan's politics. The top brass is often called the establishment. Hassan Askari Rizvi is a political analyst.
The kind of vote the PTI-supported candidate got is a message to the establishment that their policies are not acceptable at the common person level.
Not having a unified electoral symbol, PTI candidates were forced to run as independents. Iqbal worries winners could be convinced or coerced to join rival political parties.
Now that can happen through dishonest and corrupt practices by, you know, vote buying. And this can happen through arm twisting and coercion and threatening individuals and their families.
Rizvi says PTI's surprise success may not compel the military to let go of its hold on Pakistan's political landscape and let the party form a ruling coalition.
I don't think at the moment I find any chance of flexibility and a sense of accommodation in the establishment towards the PTI.
Election results were delayed for hours. The party alleges tallies were rigged to cheat it out of winning a clear majority. The Election Commission blamed the delay on internet issues. PTI released a victory speech by Khan generated through artificial intelligence.
You laid the foundation for Hakiki Azadi, true freedom, with your votes.
Three-time former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, seen as the military's favorite, also made a victory speech, claiming his party was the single most popular political entity. Observers worry Pakistan is in for a long period of political uncertainty. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Lahore, Pakistan.
Of the 50 or so countries that have held or are holding elections in 2024, none will have more people going to the polls on a single day than Indonesia. The current president is on his second term, so he's ineligible to run, leaving Indonesians with three choices to replace him when they go to vote on Wednesday. In Jakarta, VOA's Ahadian Utama reports.
Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous country, is gearing up for its upcoming presidential elections on February 14, 2024. Three candidates will run for the presidency. First candidate, 54-year-old Anies Baswedan, is a conservative Muslim voice who first came to national prominence after he was elected as the governor of Jakarta, backed by Islamic conservative groups. 72-year-old Prabowo Subianto, a former general and former son-in-law of longtime strongman Suharto, is running for the third time. He has the backing of incumbent President Joko Widodo, widely known as Jokowi. Jokowi's son, Gibran Rakabuming Raka, is Subianto's running mate. The third candidate, 55-year-old Ganjar Pranowo, is a former governor of Central Java, embracing the progressive, common man thoughts like President Jokowi. He also comes from the ruling party, the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle. Andreka Natalegawa is a Southeast Asian expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
Prabowo Subianto, the current defense minister, and Ganjar Pranowo. And so those two candidates, I think, have approached this from the frame of what are the things that we can carry on from the Jokowi administration, right? Whereas Anies Baswedan, former governor of Jakarta, his campaign has been a little bit different in the sense that it's emphasized change.
More than 204 million registered voters will vote for their next president, and 55% of them are under the age of 40. Jobs and the economy are their primary concern. Voter Rehan Zafir told VOA that he wants more job opportunities for young people, including fresh graduate like himself. Duyana Agustina says, for her, the most important thing is improving economic conditions so the prices are more affordable. On foreign policy, the three candidates have different views. Regarding dispute in the South China Sea, Pranowo endorses a temporary agreement with China and strengthening Indonesia's naval capacity and patrols. Similarly, Prabowo Subianto says dispute in the South China Sea underlined the needs for a strong defense force, platforms for patrol, and additional satellites. Meanwhile, Anies Baswedan is calling for the ASEAN groups of nations to play a bigger role in resolving disputes. Dina Wisnu is with the public policy consulting firm Synergy Policies in Jakarta.
None of the candidates was very direct in facing China. I think the bottom line is that Indonesia will continue building good relationship with China.
To win the election, candidates must obtain 50% plus one vote. Otherwise, the top two candidates are headed for a runoff in June. In several surveys, Prabowo is ahead of the other two candidates, but has not yet reached 50%. So the presidential election will likely be held in two rounds. Ahadian Utama, VOA News, Jakarta.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Greece has announced new measures to protect locals from a deluge of mainly Chinese nationals buying homes and property in exchange for residency rights in the West, what is commonly known as what we call a golden visa scheme. Anthi Karasava has this story from Athens.
For many of China's newly well-off citizens, the incentive to immigrate has been rising, feeding what is being dubbed worldwide as investment migration businesses. In recent years, there's been a massive rush of Chinese nationals to Greece, and that has created a serious housing crisis. On Friday, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said he would increase the threshold of real estate investment from around $269,000 to over $862,000 in certain pockets of the country to ease the burgeoning crisis. It is a major investment boost for the country, but also a serious measure we are considering to shield the local market, he told lawmakers in the Greek parliament. In a rare show of bipartisan support, opposition leaders sided with the plan. Because of a lingering housing shortage, they are now urging the government to block foreign home buyers from making a fortune off their investments.
Anthi Karasava, VOA News, Athens.
And finally, you know, we take for granted sometimes that the history of the world is online. But not all of it yet. And in some cases, there isn't even an effort to upload it. That's why one Nigerian nonprofit is on a mission to digitize Nigeria's history. And they're starting by uploading old copies of newspapers from 1960, the year Nigeria gained independence. Timothy Obizu has more from Lagos.
Page by fragile page, these old Nigerian newspapers are being scanned and uploaded to a back-end server. It's part of a project started by former Nigerian journalist Fuad Lawal. He says the idea came to him when he was working in a newsroom years ago.
When you want to find answers and like build context for your stories, it's hard to find archival stuff. I'm very sure you struggle to find archival footage about Nigeria. In our case, it's hard to find like even like just basic information. And so the question became like, what would it look like if we tried to make all of this history accessible?
But not just accessible to people. Lawal also wants to use all this data to make sure African stories are a part of any artificial intelligence base of knowledge.
We are at the dawn of a new information age by way of AI. And when you use like these tools, these AI tools, one of the things you quickly learn is that African information is grossly underrepresented, right? It is barely right about anything in the context of Nigeria.
This project hopes to change that. The server currently holds more than 60,000 pages of what could become Nigeria's first interactive digital newspaper archive. Historic events across six decades, including military coups, civil war, and notable elections, have so far been captured. The project has attracted nearly $40,000 in donations and is driven by volunteers like Boyega Taiwo.
I joined archiving in April last year, so almost a year now. We come here every day, we scan, we catalog, we log on our Notion just to track progress and uploading on the AWS. Coming here every day, flipping through pages, it just helps. It does something. It helps, I think, knowledge, right? Like, there's a lot of things that we've learned.
Once all the material is online, Lawal says AI-powered tools such as language translation apps, grammar checkers, and speed recognition software will have access to information about Nigeria that has never been online before.
But we believe that by digitizing these old newspapers, we're basically taking, like, dark data, that is data that is inaccessible, and we are digitizing it and making it more accessible.
Last September, the nonprofit launched the first collection of documents and is currently trying to raise $100,000 to expand. Timothy Obuzu, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has supported peace efforts in Africa for decades through its bilateral and multilateral diplomacy, and by supporting humanitarian access and protection of vulnerable populations through peacekeeping, said Jonathan Pratt, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, in recent congressional testimony. The United States has made significant financial contributions to the United Nations, which has undertaken a number of peacekeeping missions in Africa to provide help in challenging situations, explained Deputy Assistant Secretary Pratt.
These missions have helped safeguard civilian populations from armed groups and warring parties. Despite shortcomings and specific instances of unacceptable conduct by some peacekeepers.
Today we are seeing a desire from African leaders and the African Union to take the lead on peacekeeping efforts, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Pratt. UN Security Council Resolution 2719 shifts peacekeeping responsibility to African partners with financial support from the United Nations. An essential element of UN, African Union, and sub-regional missions is that they include safeguards designed to promote respect for human rights, protection of civilians, and humanitarian access, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Pratt.
AU and sub-regional missions have demonstrated a capacity to mobilize quickly, especially when provided with adequately financed and reliable logistical support mechanisms. Over time, we're seeing a trend towards sub-regional and bilateral missions because of their ability to respond quickly, as well as address countries' national interest in combating instability in their neighborhood.
It is important that missions adhere to their mandates and international law, stressed Deputy Assistant Secretary Pratt. We have developed best practices for oversight and accountability mechanisms to ensure private contractors adhere to policy direction and comply with legal standards, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Pratt.
In contrast, this is not what Russia's Wagner Group is or does. In the countries where Wagner is present, we have seen the number of terrorist attacks and attacks on civilians increase, accompanied by a decrease in humanitarian access, as well as an increase in reports of human rights abuses.
The United States remains committed to advancing democracy, peace, and security as cornerstones for a successful U.S.-Africa partnership.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.